Jiro Ono has given more than 75 years of his life to one job. The sushi chef started learning his trade at the age of 9. His father had abandoned the family, forcing Jiro's impoverished mother to send him out to a Dickensian world of kitchen work. Today, his sushi restaurant, Tsukiyabashi Jiro, is considered the best in the world. So good, it's earned the top Michelin rating of 3 stars, even though it's located deep underground next to a Tokyo subway platform. Jiro presides from behind the counter, a formidable, focused presence, his hands molding the soft rice beneath delicate slices of fish. A new documentary, Jiro Dreams of Sushi, follows the 86-year-old's almost obsessive search for the perfect sushi. The film's director, David Gelb, joined us here at NPR West. Welcome.
Thank you, Renee.
How did you get Jiro to let you follow him?
Well, I owe a great deal to the food writer Masahiro Yamamoto. I like to refer to him as a sushi poet. He was the judge of Iron Chef in Japan. He convinced Jiro that I would do a fair telling of his story.
One thing about the film that brings you in is when one first meets Jiro, you know he's amazing at what he does. You know he's the best sushi chef in the world. And yet he seems quite fierce. And bit by bit, you see this other side. He'll break out into a little smile. And it, maybe in a way that seems more of a gift.
Absolutely. When I first ate at the restaurant, I was very, very nervous because I'd heard, you know, what a serious man he is and kind of how stoic he is, and he doesn't talk to the customers, and the meal lasts 30 minutes and costs $350, and, you know, you're out of there as soon as you finish, basically. But as soon as he finished service and the customers left the restaurant, and he becomes, you know, a very personable, kind gentleman, and what I realized is that it's not that he's mean. He's just concentrating, using his full attention on the task at hand, which is making sushi. He's just focused on making every single piece of sushi the best sushi of his life.
You know, does it matter that it's such a small place? His entire restaurant consists of a bar with 10 stools?
Yeah, there are 10 seats in the bar. They do maybe one turnover for lunch and one turnover for dinner. That's all the people that he can serve to his standard, because that's all the fish that exists in the fish market that will satisfy him.
There are plenty of examples in this film of the lengths that Jiro goes to make the ultimate sushi. One of them, which he doesn't do himself, massaging the octopus. What's that?
Octopi are often tragically under-massaged in sushi restaurants.
So you end up chewing on them.
Yeah, well, octopus, you know, I think a lot of people that eat octopus in a normal sushi restaurant, especially Americans, you know, octopus isn't that popular because it's known as being chewy and it has kind of suction cups. And, you know, a lot of people think it's a piece of rubber. And Jiro laments that as well because he thinks that octopus often has no flavor. And so he developed a way to make octopus delicious. It needs to be massaged for an hour every day in order to both tenderize it and also to bring out the flavors of what the octopus has been eating. The octopus that they get has a fantastic diet of clams and shellfish, and so by massaging the octopus, they're unlocking all the flavor that's inside of it, and that's one of the reasons that Jiro's octopus is so delicious.
Your film takes us to this fish market. Let's take a listen to the sound of it. Describe for us what we're hearing.
This is the tuna auction, and the procedure has been unchanged for over 100 years. There's no digital record keeping of any kind. It's all, you know, completely analog. The auctioneers are ringing bells to indicate where the auctions are taking place on the floor, because there may be a few auctions happening at the same time for different fish. And the auctioneers are sort of like yelling, like in a Sotheby's, essentially. And it kind of takes on a very musical quality.
Almost like jazz. Whereas the rest of the film, there's a score that is classical music. And it seems as if you structure the story as a kind of symphony.
Certainly. And this is something that Yamamoto, our food writer and narrator, he conveyed this to me when I first started talking to him about Jiro and about sushi, is that Jiro's sushi, his sushi course is like a concerto. It's like a piece of music. And it has movements, and it has, you know, kind of hills and valleys, all very delicious, but the hills and valleys meaning the contrast and the flavors between the different sushi.
Throughout the film, we see sushi. sushi that's extremely elegant and exquisite to look at. Even without being able to taste it, it does give one the impression that it's quite sublime.
So they're actually quite easy to shoot because you just have to point the camera from a compelling perspective and the sushi does the work itself. First of all, just Jiro sushi, they look like jewels. You know, they are incredibly beautiful. When he places a piece of sushi on the plate, it settles into place. And Yamamoto, the food writer, describes it as the soft landing. And it's because Jiro packs the rice firmly so it retains its shape, but also very lightly so that there's air that moves within the rice.
How does it taste?
The rice is warm and fluffy, but each grain retains its perfect shape, and it's just slightly al dente at the same time. And when you put a piece of sushi in your mouth, the rice kind of poofs. Eric Repair, the French chef, described it where the rice just poofs in your mouth and it just the flavors combine with the fish. And what's happening, the rice is elevating the fish. And when you've mastered that balance like Jiro has, the only way to describe the sensation of eating it is umami. And that's kind of the perfect balance where you just taste the true essence of the fish.
And umami was communicated by his oldest son as the experience of ah.
Exactly. Umami is just the feeling of satisfaction while eating. You just are just moved by what you eat. After having eaten there and understanding all the work that goes into it, eating a piece of sushi from Jiro is really quite emotional, especially when you know the vast labors that have gone into creating that single bite.
Thank you very much for joining us.
Oh, it was a pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.
David Gelb is the director and producer of the new documentary, Jiro Dreams of Sushi. And from NPR News, this is Morning Edition, produced by Nishant Dahiya. Our senior producers are Cindy Carpy and Barry Gordimer and Jim Wildman. Senior supervising producers are Kara Tallow and Tracy Wall. Our executive producer is Madeline Kasicka. The executive editor of news programming is Ellen McDonnell. Morning Edition's theme music is written by BJ Lederman and arranged by Jim Pugh. I'm Renee Montaigne. A word to the squeamish, this next story is pretty disgusting. The U.S. Department of Agriculture announced yesterday that it would give schools the choice to order ground beef that does not contain what's known as pink slime, also known as lean beef trimmings. The USDA took action after 200,000 mothers, fathers, and concerned citizens signed a petition to get pink slime out of school cafeterias. They cited safety concerns. As NPR's Allison Aubrey reports, these controversial beef trimmings aren't just found in the burgers and tacos served at school. They may well be in the ground beef we buy in the grocery store.
In an attempt to find out whether some ground beef that I bought contains so-called pink slime, I called Don Schaffner for help. He's a food scientist at Rutgers, and I reached out to him at his lab.
Yeah, I can hear you. You're faint, but I can hear you.
Okay, all right. So I've got this package of meat here, and I'm looking at the label. Am I going to know by reading this label if there are any of these lean beef trimmings in here?
You won't know that by looking at the label.
Oh, so it's not labeled at all.
It's not required to be labeled at this point in time yet.
Now, according to estimates, about 70% of ground beef in the U.S. contains pink slime trimmings. And clearly, people are completely grossed out, disgusted by the phrase. It suggests an oozy, gooey liquid. The meat industry calls it lean, finely textured beef. So I asked Don Schaffner, what exactly is this stuff? He explained these bits come from fatty trimmings that also contain small amounts of muscle protein and connective tissue.
What the process does is it takes those mostly fat trimmings and heats them up so the fat becomes liquid and then uses a process to separate the lean portion from the fat portion.
So this makes sense. You take something fatty, extract the lean part, and maybe it does look a little pink and slimy, but so does a lot of raw meat. So here's what some people say they're worried about. There are reports that the trimmings are likely to carry pathogens, such as E. coli. And Schaffner, who consults for the meat industry, says this is true.
The bacterial risk comes from the fact that these are pieces that are being cut away from the outside of the meat. And so that's where the bacteria are likely to be. So there is a possibility of an increased risk of having pathogens or even just, you know, many different types of bacteria, not just the pathogenic type, on these products.
The industry agrees. That's why it's adopted the practice of treating the meat trimmings with ammonium hydroxide gas. This kills the pathogens. But even if it solves one problem, critics say, who wants to eat beef treated with ammonia? Betsy Boreen of the American Meat Institute Foundation maintains that it's safe in the amounts that are used.
This is not the same ammonia that you might use in cleaning supplies. It's a gas. It's a different compound. So this isn't, you know, cleaning supply that's putting in. It's actually a well-established processing intervention that has a long history of success.
And is approved by the USDA. But consumer sentiment has been turning against pink slime, or lean beef trimmings, for a while now. The fast food industry has responded, and McDonald's announced back in January of 2011 it would no longer use ammonia-treated beef in its burgers. But given that only an estimated 30% of the ground beef supply is free of these trimmings, it may now be a challenge for schools to actually find certified ammonia-free beef. According to Chef Ann Cooper of the Boulder, Colorado School District, she's trying to buy some now, and her suppliers can't seem to get their hands on any.
They can't find any. Today, my processor out of Denver can't find it for us.
Cooper says it's unclear what will happen if lots of schools and consumers start to demand hamburger meat that's free of lean, finely textured beef. Allison Aubrey, NPR News.
You can read more about pink slime and other more appetizing stories on NPR's food blog, The Salt. Another factor affecting food safety is the globalization of the U.S. food supply. A report by the Centers for Disease Control says foodborne disease outbreaks caused by imported food are on the rise, in part due to the doubling of food imports over the past decade. Imported food was linked to 39 outbreaks and more than 2,000 illnesses during this period, with nearly half of those outbreaks in just the last 3 years. The biggest culprits, imported fish and spice. The outbreaks were linked to 15 different countries, nearly half of those in Asia.
Afghanistan, of course, has often been caught up in the bitter rivalry between two of its neighbors, Pakistan and India. Those two nations have contended against each other since winning independence in 1947. In bad times, they fight wars.
In better times, Pakistan and India send their national cricket teams to play each other. And now they're taking their rivalry to an entirely new level.
The knives are out. The battle lines have been drawn. It's time to go to war.
The War is in the Kitchen, a new reality TV show on Indian television pits chefs and cuisines from the two countries against each other.
If you can't stand the heat, get out of the kitchen. But do join the feast on Foodistan.
Foodistan looks a lot like Iron Chef America, with celebrity judges watching the competition.
And the competitors face certain handicaps. Some ingredients are forbidden, others are mandatory.
Our game changer, the bulkiest banana!
My memories of banana is having it in a milkshake, and that's probably about it. You know, so I'm a little worried now.
Amazing. In my whole career, I've never cooked banana in the food, except the desserts.
Now, this program is billed as a battle between Pakistani and Indian food, though we should point out the differences can be subtle. Within living memory, Pakistan and India were part of the same country.
Some of the same dishes can be found across the subcontinent, but Pakistani chef Papi Agha, who's competing in tonight's semifinals, says there are local variations.
The greatest differences that you're going to find is regional cookery in Pakistan versus regional cookery in India.
And there are different dishes in different regions, according to Indian food writer Madhur Jaffrey.
Papa Mach, which is a steamed river fish. That would be very Indian, because Bengal is in India. And if you take chapli kebabs, beef kebab, that are fried in the fat of a fantailed sheep. Now, to me, that is Pakistani.
Now, in what may be a positive turn for bilateral food relations, chefs on the TV show have teamed up and traded cooking secrets. Pakistani contestant Papi Agha even received some sympathy and help from a rival Indian.
I fell very ill halfway through the shoot. I got this horrible, horrible flu. And Chef Manish Mehrotra called me up and he said, should I make you soup and send it from my home?
Still, competition comes first. And by the show's end this Wednesday, only one country will be able to claim victory. You can find links to the show and also winning dishes on NPR's food blog, The Salt.
Today is the first day of spring. Where we are, that means longer days outside, getting out the garden tools, and the beginning of barbecue season. For Iranian Americans and others from the Middle East, Central, and South Asia, today is the beginning of a new year. In Persian, the holiday is called Nowruz, which literally means a new day. It's seen as a time of rebirth and renewal, and like most holidays, Nowruz is all about spending time with family and eating lots of great food. To get a sense of just some of the tasty dishes served for Nowruz, we decided to call upon Iranian-American chef and author Donya Bijan. Her memoir, Maman's Homesick Pie, came out last fall. In it, she describes her mother's elaborate garden parties in Iran with amazing meals and classical Persian musicians playing in the background. So let's set the mood and cue the tape. Donya Bijan, welcome to the program. Thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you for having me, Michelle.
And what's the proper greeting?
Eid Shoma Mubarak.
Eid Shoma Mubarak. Pretty good.
Mubarak.
Mubarak. Mubarak better than that. Okay, thank you. Okay. So before we get to the actual food, I do want to talk a little bit about your story. Your memoir is an homage to your mom, who's passed away. I'm sorry for your loss. For people who haven't read your book, how did you find your love of cooking, and what role did your mom have to play in that?
Well, the book is so much a love letter to my mom because she nurtured that love and passion that I have for cooking from when I was a little girl. I was an awkward little girl who found grace in the kitchen. She never shooed me away, you know, didn't say, oh, go outside and play. She always gave me a task and expected me to follow through. And I think I knew from when I was very little that I wanted to be a cook, but it wasn't a profession, so to speak, that one would send their daughter to university for. But I knew that the seed was planted and that someday it would blossom. And it's America's fault, really, because it was here where I found my voice and realized that I can make my own choices and make my own life.
And you were trained. You are, in fact, a trained chef. You were trained at the Cordon Bleu, the premier French culinary school. You owned your own French bistro in California. Did your mom live to see you kind of embrace this love in this way?
She did. And she forced me to go to France. She insisted that I go to the source if I wanted to learn to do something well. And she took on a graveyard shift at the hospital where she was a nurse, so that she could pay for my tuition and send me to France. And she saw my restaurant open. She would come and bring her friends and boast about her daughter and clip all the little reviews. And she had a scrapbook. So she was very proud of me.
Do your two culinary heritages ever collide? I mean, you're classically trained in the French tradition, but you grew up with this heritage of amazing Persian cooking. Do the two ever collide, or do you keep them separate?
They collide every day and all the time because I'm constantly thinking about food. And when I'm making Persian food, I bring the French technique to that process. So it's been tremendously helpful. I've been told that I'm a little bossy also in the kitchen, which I must have picked up from my mentors and French chefs I worked with. You can't help but draw from all that information that's in your pantry. And I think very much that food is the perfect vessel to travel back and forth between those cultures.
You're listening to Tell Me More from NPR News. It's the first day of spring. Happy spring and happy Nowruz. We're speaking with chef and author Donya Bijan about the Persian food she indulges in for the new year. Ah, food. Let's talk about food. The new year calls for two particular mainstays, as I understand it, herb rice and fish. And you, as the chef, are responsible for that part of the meal. Why is that? Is that the hardest thing to get right?
You know, the hardest thing about that herb rice is chopping the herbs. That because they have to be done just right, and it takes forever, so you have to be patient. And it certainly teaches you that good cooking does require a lot of patience. But yes, those are the two mainstays, that spring herb rice, which is fresh herbs like cilantro, parsley and dill that are folded into the rice, and along with brand new shoots of garlic and leeks, and all that green represents rebirth, which is the central theme of Nowruz. And also it's served with fish, and fish represents life, which, you know, is not complicated to make the fish part, but it's the rice part that the new generation of Iranian Americans, myself being part of that, we should have paid closer attention to when our mothers and grandmothers were making that dish.
Well, I don't want to call any names here, but our producer, Sanas Mishkinpour, had quite a few words about how long it took to make this dish. It was, I believe, 3 hours, although it may have gotten longer in the retelling. But it turned out quite beautifully, I must say. And if you don't mind, Donya, I'm going to have just a teeny little bite here. It has a beautiful, its crust isn't quite right.
That's the tadig, and that's the prize of your meal. That, you know, you've worked so hard, but that is the best part. Families fight over that part
of the really?
Dish.
Oh, do they really?
Oh,
okay.
Oh,
well,
yes.
This is interesting. Well, I'm fending off all comers in here. Forgive me. I'm going to have a little bite.
Nusha John.
It's delicious. Mmm. How do you, you don't live in Iran now, obviously, but people are preparing for the holiday for quite some time. How do you translate that here? Do you feel sort of sad in a way when, because people around you aren't as engaged with it as you would be? Does it kind of bum you out a little bit, or what do you do to kind of get the excitement level up?
You know, it's bittersweet. As far as for those of us who live in exile, I myself for too long relied on my mother to carry the tradition of Nowruz. Like I said earlier, I didn't pay close enough attention. But being that we are the sons and daughters of that generation, and it's up to us to continue to teach the rituals and the smells of Nowruz to our children, to the next generation. And I fumble through a lot of it, but, you know, there is a determination to get it right and to pass along those traditions.
Donya Bijan is a chef and an author. She is author of the memoir, Maman's Homesick Pie. To get the recipes for her spring rice and salmon dishes, go to npr.org/tellmemore. And happy spring and happy Nowruz. And once again, it is
Eid Shoma Mubarak.
Eid Shoma Mubarak.